This episode of Court Junkie is sponsored by Home Chef. Because sometimes I need a break from not only true crime, but American politics. Last night I took a break from it all and made a homemade meal from Home Chef. Acapulco steak tacos with pico de gallo and cilantro lime rice. Home Chef delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients with step-by-step recipe cards right to your door. So not only do you learn how to cook an awesome meal, but you can save both time and money by not having to go to the grocery store to get more ingredients than you need. And because Home Chef is now a sponsor of this podcast, you can all now get $30 off of your first order, which is a great deal. Just go to homechef.com/courtjunkie. It's also a great way to support this podcast. And now on to episode 7 of the Court Junkie podcast. A quick thank you, as always, to everybody who has subscribed, shared, donated, or left me a review. I would love to talk to you guys about these cases, so my fellow court junkies, please consider joining my Facebook group. Just go to Facebook and search for the Court Junkie Discussion Group. Today I'm going to cover a case I've written about on courtjunkie.com numerous times. The disappearance of a 17-year-old girl from Lovingston, Virginia. It's the story of a beautiful young small-town girl whose life was stolen from her by a local predator who was hiding right in plain sight. And then, of course, the trial that followed. This is about the disappearance of Alexis Murphy. In August 2013, Alexis Murphy was 17 years old, a girl with what seemed like her whole life ahead of her. She was a middle child. She had an older brother and a younger brother. The Murphy family lived in a very rural town in Nelson County, Virginia, called Shipman. And when I say very rural, I mean that the population in Shipman as of July 2016 was only 524 people. At the time of her disappearance, Alexis was about to become a senior at Nelson County High School. She was pretty, popular, and was the co-captain of her school's volleyball team. I spoke with Trina Murphy, Alexis's great aunt. Can you tell me a little bit about Alexis herself? Like, what is she like? What sort of things did she like to do?
So Alexis was a rising senior at Nelson County High School. The day she was abducted, she actually was going to purchase some beauty products and hair extensions to take her senior pictures that following Wednesday. Very, you know, outgoing. She was one of those people that everybody liked. I always used to say that she had the kind of beauty that when she walked into a room, other women had to notice her because she was just that striking, even when she had on sweatpants and a t-shirt, you know. But she never knew it. She wasn't, you know, boastful or conceited at all, and I'm not even sure she knew how beautiful she was at that point in her life. But very outgoing, very athletic. She played basketball. Volleyball was her favorite sport. She was looking forward to playing volleyball in college. Started thinking about, you know, where she wanted to go to school, very much into fashion and makeup and her hair. And so even though she was very athletic, she was also a girly girl and had her own sense of style and just was, she had a great sense of confidence about her.
When was the last time you saw or spoke with her?
I spoke with Alexis the Saturday prior to her abduction. I had been at my sister-in-law's house or her grandmother's house, and we had just kind of hung out and, you know, just did our usual talk. She was on her phone most of the time, as most teenagers her age are, and, you know, but we did our normal routine, and we went back home on that Sunday. I actually spent the night there that weekend and came back to our home in Charlottesville that week and had a good week and, you know, didn't really talk to her again after that.
On August 3rd, 2013, by all accounts, Alexis was in great spirits. She had just received a raise that morning from her job at Kid to Kid in Charlottesville, a consignment store for children's clothing and toys. A little after 6 p.m. in the evening, she told her mom that she was going to drive to Lynchburg, about 40 miles away, to buy hair extensions for her upcoming senior portrait. At 6:40 p.m., Alexis tweeted, "I actually look cute right now." For someone who is very active on Twitter, this would be her last tweet. She then got into her dad's white Nissan Maxima and headed out. When Alexis didn't return home later that night and her family couldn't get a hold of her, they were alarmed. Trina told me that the Murphy family is a very tight-knit group, and in fact, almost their entire community is that way. So when Alexis was first reported missing, word quickly spread through the area.
I received the phone calls the following Sunday morning, which would have been August the 4th, from my niece, her aunt, and she was just screaming hysterically in the phone, and I really couldn't even make out what she was saying, and she just finally got out the words, Alexis didn't come home last night. And I knew immediately that something was wrong because that was just really out of character for her. And I know people question that because, yes, she was 17 and she had a car, but people didn't understand that Alexis really never was even late for her curfew without calling, even if she was only going to be 10 minutes late. That's just who she was. And for her not to come home and not to have any contact with her mom or her grandmother or any of her friends at that point, just I knew something really bad had happened. Of course, at that point, I was thinking she'd had a car accident or, you know, never once did abduction cross my mind, but I knew something bad had happened.
On August 6th, 3 days after she was last seen, Nelson County Police found the car Alexis had been driving. It was abandoned in the parking lot of the Carmike Movie Theater just north of Charlottesville, about 40 miles away from Shipman. On August 8th, 5 days after Alexis was last seen, police released surveillance images to the public. The images showed Alexis at the Liberty gas station in Lovingston at 7:15 p.m. on August 3rd, shortly after she had left her home. An employee at the gas station told reporters that she saw Alexis talking to a man in the parking lot. The surveillance images showed Alexis walking into the gas station. She was wearing a pink long-sleeved shirt, floral print spandex pants, and brown boots, and she was carrying a gray purse. The sheriff's office, the FBI, and the Virginia State Police conducted extensive ground and aerial searches for Alexis, mostly focusing on the areas around Lovingston, where her cell phone last pinged. Trina told me how she herself tried tracking Alexis's cell phone.
You know, when this first happens, you really just, you don't know what to do. You don't even know where to start looking. And I have an iPhone. Alexis had an iPhone, and I used the app iPhone Finder. I was like, well, you know, we can find her phone. I didn't know at that time that iPhone Finder literally is, it tracks within a 7 mile radius of the last place that your last tower your phone pinged off of. And so where we began to search is where my iPhone said that her iPhone was. And where we started the search in the Oak Ridge area of Nelson County was just a little over 7 miles from Randy Taylor's residence.
It wasn't long before investigators made an arrest in the case. On Sunday, August 11th, authorities arrested 48-year-old Randy Allen Taylor and charged him with felony abduction by force. Randy Taylor was a local man who lived in a trailer just north of Lovingston, about a mile and a half from the gas station where Alexis had been seen in the surveillance video. Had you ever heard or seen Randy Taylor prior to Alexis's disappearance? Like, did you have any idea who he was?
I had no idea who he was. I like to say, you know, now looking back, that he was the type of person that just hid in plain sight. I remember seeing the truck at, you know, local stores. I remember seeing the truck on the road that Alexis lived on. But, you know, we live in the country, so there's a lot of trucks with camo wraps on them. You know, it's not something unusual. Yeah, I just feel like he was hiding in plain sight. You know, I didn't know his name. I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know that he had, you know, a child that went to school with Alexis. I didn't know any of that. But, yeah, I certainly had seen him and his vehicle in the past.
Authorities announced that Randy was being held without bond at the local jail. And as news about potential evidence against him started trickling out, the hope of finding Alexis alive was dwindling. Alexis's cell phone had last pinged not far from Randy's trailer. And what's more, Randy was no stranger to being involved in a missing persons investigation. 3 years prior, in September 2010, 19-year-old Samantha Clark went missing from Orange, Virginia. And guess who the last person Samantha had talked to prior to her disappearance was? Yep, Randy Taylor. No arrests have ever been made in that case, and to this day, it remains unsolved. But the fact that Randy was a person of interest in Samantha's disappearance certainly didn't do him any favors in this case. Randy also had a pretty lengthy criminal record that included assault charges, stalking, statutory burglary, grand larceny, arson, and brandishing a firearm. Shortly after Randy's arrest and Alexis's abduction, FBI agents executed a search warrant on his property. Canine units were also on scene, searching the surrounding area for any signs of Alexis. And meanwhile, Randy was talking and giving his own version of the story, to the public and through his attorney. Randy's attorney, Michael Hallahan, went in front of reporters claiming that police needed to be looking for somebody else. He said Randy's version of events goes like this. Randy met Alexis by chance at the Liberty gas station on the night of August 3rd. He had parked his car to get cigarettes, and she had been pumping gas. Alexis made a comment to him about marijuana because she had seen him smoking a few weeks prior. Randy told her that he was looking to get some more, and she said she knew a guy. He said they then met up with a third man, a black male with cornrows. They then all drove to Randy's trailer, where Randy says he and the unidentified male smoked and drank. After about an hour, the man and Alexis left the trailer and drove away in their separate cars. Hallahan told reporters that Randy shared this information with police, but that police weren't doing anything about it. He also claimed that police had arrested Randy because they had found a hair on his pillow, which he said doesn't prove anything. Meanwhile, the Nelson County community was consumed with Alexis's disappearance. 3.5 weeks after she disappeared, her volleyball team played their first game without her, and they sported pink ribbons in their hair. A Lovingston flower shop owner started distributing pink bows in honor of Alexis, and community members raised money for her parents, who both reportedly took a leave from work since her disappearance. And it continued as the months went by and there were still no signs of Alexis. In October, Nelson County High School hosted a pink out at their home football game, and in December, a Christmas tree with pink lights and bows was resurrected at the Liberty gas station where she was last seen. And then, in January 2014, more than 5 months after Alexis disappeared, there was more movement in the case. Randy's charges were upgraded to murder. The upgraded charges obviously meant that law enforcement had significant reason to believe that Alexis was deceased and that she would no longer be coming home. It also meant that the state would likely have a difficult task ahead of them, trying the murder case without a body. I spoke to Tad DiBiase, a former federal homicide prosecutor and author of the book No Body Homicide Cases, A Practical Guide to Investigating, Prosecuting, and Winning Cases When the Victim is Missing.
When you don't have the body, you don't have the best piece of evidence in the case. A body can tell you where the murder happened. Did it happen indoors? Did it happen outdoors? Did it happen in an alley? Did it happen in a car? The body also tells you how a murder happened. Was it poisoning, a shooting, a strangling, a blunt force trauma? And it also tells you when a murder happened. Did it happen just now? Is there a body in an alley? Did it happen a few hours ago because rigor mortis hasn't set in? Did it happen many days ago or many months ago or many years ago because we're only finding bones and a skull and those types of things? When you don't have the body, you don't have any of that evidence. You may have some evidence of a scene left behind, but there's so many things that you don't have.
There's a common misperception that it's not possible to try somebody for murder without having the body. I find that most people you ask tend to think that way, but that's not true. It is possible, and while it's true that there are definitely more hurdles to go through, as DiBiase said, having a body is not crucial to the case. What goes into the decision to try a case without a body? So when the case comes to you, how do you decide, you know, to proceed with it or not? Is there specific things that you're looking for?
Well, when I'm consulting on cases, what I try and do is look at what I call a quantum of evidence. How much evidence do you have? Are you able to show that the person is clearly dead? That's the first step. If you can't prove that, it doesn't matter if you have a viable suspect, because you have to prove that first thing first. Once you've jumped over that hurdle, then you have to say, do you have a good, viable suspect that you can prove beyond a reasonable doubt? One of the important things in the no body is to eliminate anyone else as a viable suspect, which becomes more difficult when you don't have a body. You don't know where she is, where did she die, when did she die, all of those things. So I look at what evidence do you have, and then I try and compare to cases that have gone before. Most no-body murder cases, as I mentioned earlier, have what I call the three-legged stool. You have forensic evidence, you have confession to friends and family, or confession to police. I look for those three things because that's the most common quantum of evidence.
DiBiase's website, nobodycases.com, notes that as of March 2016, there were 459 trials in the United States that fell under the murder without a body category. And the conviction rate for those was about 88%. Now, before I get into Randy's trial, I want to stop here for a second and tell you guys about an additional episode series that I'm working on. They're called Court Junkie Briefs. In these mini episodes, I'll focus on one court-related topic at a time, and I'll be speaking with legal experts, authors, attorneys, etc. Since I'm a self-professed court junkie, I find these legal topics fascinating. And if you're a court junkie like I am, I think you will too. My first brief is going to be with Tad DiBiase, the man you just heard, and we're going to go even more in depth about these murder without a body cases. He's going to tell you about the first no-body murder case he tried, how he trains other prosecutors, and what he thinks are the biggest challenges of all. These briefs will be released every other week starting next week, so keep your eyes and especially your ears open for them. Now on to Randy's trial. Randy's trial began on April 25th, 2014. He was pleading not guilty to first-degree murder during an abduction, and abduction with intent to defile. The Commonwealth, in their opening statements, immediately addressed the fact that Alexis had not yet been found. Nelson County Commonwealth's attorney Anthony Martin told the jurors that the law does not require there to be a body in order to convict somebody of murder. Attorney Martin said that August 3, 2013, started out as a great day for Alexis, but that the day took a dark and terrible turn when she crossed paths with Randy Allen Taylor at the Liberty gas station in Lovingston. Attorney Martin said that Randy, whom he called a short, wiry man with a tattoo of Daffy Duck on his neck, spoke with Alexis at the gas station. And then moments later, the cashier saw her following his camouflaged truck out of the parking lot and onto US 29, heading north. Attorney Martin then outlined the physical evidence against Randy, something the public was hearing for the first time since the case had been under a gag order. In Randy's trailer, investigators had found a bloody T-shirt with Alexis's DNA on it, a piece of Alexis's hair extensions and fake eyelashes, a torn fingernail, a diamond stud from one of her piercings, and a hair belonging to her that was on Randy's pillow. Attorney Martin said the evidence showed that a violent struggle had taken place inside of Randy's trailer, and that her cell phone, which she never parted with, was later found destroyed near his home. Randy's attorney, Michael Hallahan, told the jury in his opening statements that not only does the evidence not prove abduction and murder, but that there was another man who was the more likely suspect, Damian Bradley, the black male with cornrows that Taylor claims was with Alexis and him the day of Alexis's disappearance. Hallahan said that Damian was not thoroughly investigated by police. Hallahan said that Alexis's disappearance is a tragedy and that somebody should pay for it, but he said that the Commonwealth would not be able to prove that it was Randy beyond a reasonable doubt. He told the jury, don't let emotion get to you. This case is about, did Randy Taylor abduct or kill her? The Commonwealth then began to lay out their case. Alexis's mother, Laura Murphy, testified that she last saw her daughter after 6 p.m. on August 3rd, when Alexis said she was going to go to Lynchburg to get her hair done. She said Alexis would always call if she was going to be late coming home, and that the family was alarmed when they couldn't get a hold of her. She said she had spoken with Alexis once before about what to do if anybody ever tried to harm her, and that Alexis had said, "I would fight." Attorney Martin played the surveillance video from the gas station from the night Alexis disappeared in court. The video was from about 7:15, and in the video, Randy is seen holding the door open for Alexis. The video then shows Alexis's car following Randy's out of the parking lot onto Route 29 and heading north, the opposite of where she was supposed to be heading. This was the last time Alexis was ever seen. Two cashiers from the gas station testified. One of them said she saw Randy and Alexis talking in the parking lot on August 3rd, and the other one said that Randy often came into the gas station about three times a week, and that he would park his car in the same spot and gawk at all the young girls. Attorney Martin also played surveillance video from the Charlottesville parking lot where the car Alexis had been driving was found. The video wasn't clear enough to see the driver, but Attorney Martin claimed that Randy had gone to the Applebee's in that same neighborhood right after the car was parked. He said Randy then took a cab back to Nelson County. And then came the graphic testimony that was difficult for Alexis's family to hear. An investigator said that during numerous search warrants executed on Randy's trailer, multiple items related to Alexis were seized. Investigators found the t-shirt that Randy had been wearing in the gas station video. They found it balled up underneath his couch. The shirt was bloody, and Alexis was found to be a major contributor to the DNA from the bloodstains, and Randy was a potential minor contributor of the DNA. The investigator said that inside the balled-up shirt was a hair extension and false eyelashes, both of which contained Alexis's DNA. Another forensic expert testified that a hair found on Randy's pillow was a match to a hair from Alexis's hairbrush, and that it exhibited characteristics of being forcibly removed. A diamond stud and a torn fingernail, both with Alexis's DNA, were also found. A tool marks and firearms specialist with the FBI testified that the torn fingernail had not been removed with the tool, like nail clippers, but that it had also been forcibly removed.
It was very difficult, obviously, to sit and listen to all the physical evidence that was presented, everything from, you know, her Monroe piercing and her eyelashes and her nails that were ripped off, and, you know, experts testifying to the fact that they were forcibly removed and, you know, weren't cut. And it's just that the detail was heart-wrenching. You know, it was just very hard to listen to and imagine what the last few moments of her life must have been like.
Special Agent Brittany Wampler testified that some of the female FBI agents who searched Randy's trailer were uncomfortable with Randy and that he had a very intense stare. She said he was making her so uncomfortable that she asked a supervisor to take him elsewhere during the search. Attorney Martin also played two recorded interviews with Randy, from August 5th and another one from August 7th. On the August 5th tape, from just 2 days after Alexis disappeared, Randy denies having ever seen Alexis or being at the Liberty gas station on August 3rd. In the August 7th interview, police tell Randy that they have him on surveillance video at the gas station, talking to Alexis. Randy says that he had gone four-wheeling that day and that he had no memory of going to the gas station or talking to Alexis because he had been drinking. Investigator Billy Mays testified alongside another interview from August 7th. Randy says in that interview that he was at the Applebee's on Route 29 the night that Alexis's car had been dropped off at the nearby theater parking lot. He said that a friend had dropped him off at that Applebee's and that he then took a cab back to Nelson County. In the recording, Mays tells Randy that things are closing in on him and that this is not going to go away. Randy tells him, "If y'all want to arrest me, go ahead. That's fine." An electronics engineer for the FBI testified that he analyzed a white iPhone 4 that had been found by trained dogs in a wooded area less than 100 feet from Randy's trailer. The iPhone was determined to be Alexis's, and the back of the phone was completely removed. The battery had been ripped out, and the phone's processor was cracked, meaning no information could be recovered from the phone. Another disturbing piece of evidence that was shown to the jury was something that had been found at an abandoned house on the same property as Randy's trailer. It was a scrapbook with headshots of a young white female. John Cromer with the Virginia State Police said that in some of the images, the female's head was cut out and taped to pictures of women wearing lingerie. Cromer said police had spoken with the girl's parents about it and that they weren't releasing the girl's name. Tell me that isn't creepy. Randy's defense attorney emphasized that the scrapbook was found in the abandoned house and not in Randy's trailer, and that Randy's son spent a lot of time in that house. Yet another recorded interview with Randy was played in court, this time from August 11th, 8 days after Alexis's disappearance. For the first time, Randy admits to investigators that he was with Alexis on August 3rd, but only after they tell him that DNA evidence proves that he was with her. He tells them, "I didn't hurt the girl. I didn't hurt the girl at all." He then goes into the story about how Alexis helped him get some weed and that they met up with a black man with cornrows, a man named Damian Bradley. He said all three of them went back to Randy's trailer. He said he and Damian drank and smoked, and then an hour later, Alexis and Damian left in separate cars. Randy was arrested shortly after this interview. Damian Bradley testified next in court. Damian said that he used to work at the McDonald's in the Liberty gas station and that he was friends with Alexis on Facebook, but that he had never even been in the same room as her before. Damon said he was interviewed by the FBI and that he supplied DNA evidence to clear himself as a suspect. He said he had an alibi for the night in question and that he and his girlfriend stayed at a hotel in Madison Heights, about 35 minutes away. He also stated that he does not drive or even own a car. The last testimony from the prosecution came from one of Randy's fellow inmates, who testified that Randy had told him that the first time he saw Alexis, he wanted to expletive her his way. He said Randy also admitted to having vacuumed up Alexis's hair. The defense argued that the inmate was not credible and was only searching for fame. The defense called a total of 11 witnesses. Two women testified that on August 3rd, they saw a young woman who looked like Alexis. She was walking across the shopping center parking lot near the Liberty gas station with another female. They said that this was at 8:30 p.m. and that they were sure of it because one of them had saved the receipt from the grocery store they had just left. Other witnesses were friends and ex-boyfriends of Alexis's, who testified that it was out of character for her to not answer her phone or reply to text messages. They were asked by the defense if Alexis was a different person on social media than she was in person. One of Alexis's best friends said that she had a more wild personality on Twitter, but that she was very humble and was completely different in person. Randy did not testify. In closing arguments, the state went over all the physical evidence and then said that there is no evidence that Alexis left Randy's trailer alive. They said Randy was a hunter looking for prey and that Randy abducted Alexis to satisfy his sexual urges. They said Randy then silenced Alexis so that she could never tell what really happened. The prosecutor reiterated that the jury just needs proof beyond a reasonable doubt, not all doubt. The defense's closing arguments focused on Damian Bradley, saying that investigators got the wrong man. The defense also brought up the fact that police didn't find the balled-up shirt during their first search of Andy's trailer, and that it took them a long time to find Alexis's phone on the property too. The defense said the evidence does not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Randy abducted or murdered Alexis, but that instead, this could be a case of human trafficking. In the rebuttal, the prosecutor held up the bloody shirt and hair extensions that had been found in Randy's trailer, and he said to the jury, "No abduction and no murder?"
I don't know that there's words to describe what the trial was like. It was 6 days. It was just a numbing event, you know. Literally, you were numb for 6 days. And I remember when they called us back down for the verdict, it was like walking to your own death sentence. It really was, because you just had no idea what was going to happen. And there was, during that 6 days, there was every imaginable emotion possible. And to have to, you know, it's a very small courtroom, so we were in very close proximity to Randy Taylor. And it was difficult, you know, it was difficult at best.
After deliberating for 6 hours, the jury of 8 women and 6 men found Randy guilty of first-degree murder in the commission of an abduction and abduction with intent to defile. Alexis's mother, Laura Murphy, spoke to the jury during victim impact statements and said that the last 10 months had been a living hell for her family. She said, "I just miss my daughter so much." And just then, Randy stood up and began to storm out of the courtroom. Several deputies grabbed him and escorted him out. He remained absent and didn't get to hear the jury's recommendation, which was that he be sentenced to 2 life sentences. At the sentencing hearing in July 2014, Attorney Martin asked the judge to sentence Randy to the maximum of life in prison. He pointed to Randy's prior convictions of arson, fraud, burglary, and grand larceny. He argued that Randy took the life of a young girl in her prime and disposed of her in such a way that her family doesn't have a burial for their daughter. Randy's defense team said that because Randy was 48 years old, he already has a life sentence, no matter what the judge decides. And then something unexpected happened. In a shocking last-ditch effort to get a shorter sentence, Randy's attorney said that although his client maintains his innocence, he would give up Alexis's location in exchange for a 20-year sentence. Both the prosecution and Alexis's family refused the offer, saying that Randy had ample opportunities to say where she was and that her life was worth more than that. When I first heard that Alexis's family had turned the offer down, to be completely honest with you, I was a little surprised. Oftentimes in cases like these, there's a chance to make a deal with the devil, so to speak. A chance to offer a lighter sentence in exchange for the ability to find your loved one's body and give them the proper burial you know that they deserve. But the other side of it is that you're then letting the killer off easily. You're rewarding them for concealing the body. And you just might be putting somebody else at risk when the killer gets out. I mean, what would you do? I spoke with Trina about their decision.
He had offered that on the table, and we denied it just simply for the fact that I think he was, 46. I don't even know how old he was, but he would have been young enough to still reoffend if he got out in 20 years. And the simple fact is this man is a serial predator. He's a sociopath, and he does not need to be walking the streets with access to other young women. And we never wanted this kind of pain to be exacted on any other family. And we felt like we had a moral responsibility to make sure that did not happen. I don't know that it was that daunting of a task that we just kind of were like, we can't do this, you know. We have a large family. Alexis is from a large family, and there's a lot of young nieces and nephews and cousins and, you know, and not to mention all the people in our community that have young kids. Like, we just didn't think it was... Even if he left Nelson County and never came back, which probably would not have happened, but what about all the other people in all the other communities and all the young children? I think we all know from everything that we've seen that child abductors and child abusers and pedophiles are not rehabilitated. You know, they get out and they reoffend. And that's just not something that I think that any of us could live with at that point.
The judge went with the jury's recommendation and sentenced Randy to 2 life sentences, as well as an extra 6 years suspended, to make sure he's on supervised probation if he ever does get out of prison. Randy filed an appeal, of course, and on February 22, 2016, his appeal was denied. This past August, for the anniversary of Alexis's disappearance, dozens of people in Nelson County gathered outside the gas station in Lovingston, where she had last been seen alive. Members of her family and the community gave short speeches and shared stories about Alexis. Dozens of bright pink balloons were released, and a large banner was erected with a picture of Alexis with the word missing and information on who to call if she's seen. Next to the banner was a small tree with pink bows and ornaments. A wooden sign that says Alexis with photographs will soon be added to the display. Alexis's family has also started a scholarship in her name, and they're determined to do what they can to make sure that nobody else's family goes through what they've been through.
So we do have the Alexis Murphy Scholarship Fund, and you can go on the Help find Alexis Murphy webpage, and there's information on there about the scholarship, or you can reach out to me on Facebook. I'm just on there as Trina Murphy, TrinaMurphy, and I will get you the information if people want to make a donation to the scholarship. I and her Aunt Angela are both community outreach coordinators for the organization Help Save the Next Girl, and so we do a lot of benefit work and raising awareness through that organization. I try to speak to local high school students and middle school students and whatever organization would like to have me to talk about situational awareness and abduction. You know, prior to Alexis, I had followed some of the major cases like Morgan Harrington, obviously afterwards Hannah Graham here in our area. And, you know, I think back to the fact that I never really thought to talk to my 17-year-old niece about being abducted. You know, if you haven't ever done this, it's kind of like you talk to little kids about that. You know, she was 5'7", 140-odd pounds, very athletic. I just didn't think this was something that necessarily would happen to her. It wasn't in the forefront of my mind, and I think that was, you know, that was a huge mistake on our part. But we just need to be talking to young people about the fact that, you know, this is possible. Literally, if this can happen to us, it can happen to anybody, because Alexis was abducted in a very rural area in broad daylight in the middle of the summer. You know, it's mind-blowing, really.
Searches are still ongoing, and anyone with information concerning the whereabouts of Alexis Murphy should contact the Nelson County Sheriff's Office at 434-263-7050. To see photos, court docs, and additional information about the case, you can go to my website at courtjunkie.com. And be sure to join my Facebook group so we can discuss the case. I'd love to get your opinion on these no-body murder cases, as well as what you think you would do if you were ever in the same situation as the Murphy family. Do you think you'd let Randy get a shorter sentence in exchange for the location of your loved one? And that's all for this episode. A special thank you to Trina Murphy for sharing Alexis's story and to Tad DiBiase for sharing his insight on no-body murder cases. Visit nobodycases.com for more information and be on the lookout for my first Court Junkie brief on the topic. A special thank you also goes out to Home Chef for sponsoring this episode, as well as to all of my Patreon supporters, listeners, subscribers, and everybody who shares this podcast. Thank you for your support. If you like the show, please leave me a review. You can find me on Twitter at CourtJunkiePod, Facebook at CourtJunkie, and you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Court Junkies.